Wars of Doctor Who. Star Wars of Doctor Who. Star Wars of Doctor Who.
His name is Rob.
His name is Rob.
He knows his Wookiees from his Daleks. Listen now.
Listen now.
Hear the Force challenge the TARDIS. Get your blue milk and jelly babies while we see which drives you crazy. Star Wars or Doctor Who.
Hey everyone, and welcome to Who Wars, the podcast for those among us who just can't decide between Star Wars and Doctor Who. I'm your host, Rob Irwin, and isn't this just an awesome time to be a Star Wars and Doctor Who fan? We've just had Star Wars Rebels premiere on TV, with a long run of episodes out ahead of us. Episode 7 rumours come in by the bucket load. Meanwhile, we're just starting our run on the final 6 episodes of this series of Doctor Who, but also looking ahead to the Doctor Who Christmas special. Plus, there are books and audios and toys and all sorts of stuff for both IPs continuing to roll out. It just doesn't stop. It's amazing. For those of us who live through extremely lean periods with both Star Wars and Doctor Who at different times over the years, days like these are just, well, they just seem a bit unreal at times because, you know, you've seen the alternative. To those who have never seen lean times, make the most of what we have today because although it looks pretty good, everything ebbs and flows in the fullness of time. Gosh, that was a bit more philosophical than I thought I would be at the start of the show. Moving on, how was your week? I had a whole lot going on this week, and when you listen to this episode in its entirety and its spin-off this coming Wednesday, if you're on the Doctor Who side of the fence, you'll see why. I did a lot of behind-the-scenes work this week. And, you know, not just behind the scenes either. I just want to say I had a bonkers week play out quite publicly on Twitter as well, in terms of the people who I got to speak to. I don't know what it was this week, but I was tossing comments left and right and getting responses from some pretty big hitters. I asked Neil Gaiman, for example, who will be familiar to Doctor Who fans listening for his 2 Doctor Who scripts in recent times, but he is so much more besides. I asked him how many copies of his novel, The Ocean at the End of the Lane, he reckons he signed. He replied to me within minutes, 150,000 he reckons. Wow, imagine signing your name 150,000 times in the past few months, gosh. Then I was tweeting to Australian Star Wars Rebels fans about the debut episode that was about to air here on our cable network Foxtel. Just for fun, I tossed in Vanessa Marshall's Twitter handle into the message as well. She, of course, plays Hera on the show. And, you know, knock me down with a feather, she replies with a, "Let's do this!" in capital letters, exclamation mark, exclamation mark. Then she says, "Let me know what you think. Kiss, hug." And I thought, oh, okay, gosh. And I replied, "You bet!" And she tossed a favourite onto my reply. It was very strange. Later on, I tweeted to her that the first episode was really great, you know, once I'd seen it, and I couldn't wait to say more in this podcast. And she replied to that too. "So great to hear!" Exclamation mark, exclamation mark, exclamation mark. "That is great news!" Exclamation mark, exclamation mark, exclamation mark. Kiss, hug, kiss, hug. She's a very friendly person on Twitter. But, you know, while getting a reply from Neil Gaiman was great, and having Vanessa Marshall bouncing all over the place, so happy to interact with her fans was awesome, you know, it was Freddie Prinze Jr. who made me a fan this week. How so? Well, I was on Twitter, and I got the sense that Freddie was online and being very chatty. He was tossing out questions and comments, and he clearly wanted people to respond to them. And one of his comments was about the 501st Legion. And being a former member of the 501st Legion, I chanced my hand a bit and made a comment to him, which started a mini-conversation that went, well, a little something like this. Me. I've marched in some of those back in my 501st days. I was referring to a parade here that he'd been referring to, I think. Freddy. Those guys are super cool. They do the Special Olympics, too. Met a couple of 501s at Toy Fair, New York City. Hashtag 501st got your back. And then I replied, I really enjoyed my time in the ranks. Imperial officer here all the way. Freddie replies with a emoticon, it's a fist bump. I thought, oh, that's pretty cool. I thought it would probably end there. But then Freddie comes back a few minutes later with another comment, and he says to me, some jerk in the green room gave him a hard time. Took him aside, had a chat, he came back a better citizen. Hashtag bullybuster. And I'm not too sure what he's referring to here. Obviously, he was somewhere where someone from the 501st got hassled and he stood in. I don't know where this green room was, whether it was for a TV show or a recent Rebels appearance, perhaps, or I don't know. So I replied to him, "High five, mate. It's not always easy at public events, especially in a costume where you're not masked. People say all sorts of stuff." And that's very true, actually, if I can digress. When I would go out with the 501st, being an Imperial officer, you don't have the helmet or the bucket, as we call it, on your head of a stormtrooper or a bounty hunter or someone like that, even a Death Star gunner, perhaps. And people can look you in the eye and make, you know, contact with you on a one-to-one human basis. And sometimes they say stuff that can be strange, and sometimes they say stuff that can be cruel. The public, as anyone who works in a grocery store or a doctor's office or anywhere where you deal with the public can be a strange beast as a whole. And when you're in the 501st, you know, you can be a little immune from it. If you've got a bucket on your head, you can kind of ignore people. But if you're in a soft costume without a bucket, it's tough sometimes. So that's what I was conveying to Freddie there. And I went on to add, but the camaraderie and the good times and the people it excites and the kids who want photos make it all worthwhile, regardless. And Freddie replied, "Well, you think stormtroops are bad ace. Respect." And I wasn't too sure what he meant by that, so luckily he came back another few seconds later, and Freddie says, "I, not you, hashtag big thumbs, tiny buttons." And so what he really meant to say was, "Well, I think stormtroops are bad ace. Respect." I think by bad ace he means bad ass, as the Americans would say. I said to him, so this conversation is just going on and on. I say to him, "You should do a troop. They will kit you out, mingle anonymously with the public, who won't know who's really under the bucket." Wink. Freddie says, "Shh, I did that at Comic Con once. Never told that story. Hehe. That's right, people. I was right next to you 8 years ago." So, hey, we got an exclusive from Freddie Prinze Jr. He was there, I guess, as a stormtrooper or some other kind of masked Star Wars character at Comic Con 8 years ago. Exclusive right here on Who Wars, straight from Freddie Prinze Jr. I said to him, "Awesome, but just think, now you can go up to people and say, 'So, how about that Rebels?' and see what they say." Now, I must confess, that's where the conversation ended. But what a funny conversation that was. And when I told my wife, who's a major, major, major Mass Effect fan, she was like, "No way, you chatted with James Vega," who's his character in that particular game. And she said, "If I told my Mass Effect friends, they'd lose their tiny minds." So that was pretty cool. And funnily enough, since that conversation, I've had more back and forth with Freddie and Vanessa on Twitter. Obviously, with the debut of Rebels, they're out there on social and really engaged with fans in a way that perhaps might be a little out of the ordinary. But at the same time, it still feels quite genuine from them both, too. And, you know, that's why Freddie made me a fan this week. Just the sheer length and breadth of these conversations we had compared to what is a, quotation marks, normal exchange with anyone on Twitter, if you even get one, you know, I guess. I mean, let me try and explain that. You know, you sometimes come across people who are, you know, quite minor in the grand scheme of things, if I can put it that way. Say it's someone with a podcast and a few hundred followers on Twitter or whatever, and they toss out a question on Twitter and you answer it, and they don't even reply, even though you can follow the conversation and see that only two or three people replied max, and yet they don't reply to any of them. You sometimes wonder, what's up with that person? Why are they tossing out requests for people to engage with them if they don't want to actually engage? Do they understand social media? And then you have someone like Freddie, who's a million times better known and just launched a successful TV show, and you say something, you know, casually to him, and he initiates a whole conversation. You know, that's classy. That's very cool. It's totally unexpected as well. And so that's why I watched Rebels a couple of days ago, and sometimes when Kanan was speaking, I think, that's my mate Freddie. We were just talking on Twitter. What a cool guy. And, you know, that's how you make friends and fans for life. Bravo, Freddie, and bravo, Vanessa, and Neil, and all these other celebs who use Twitter in a meaningful way and really engage with people, not just as a one-way advertisement for themselves. These folk really, really get it. I had more listener comments this week about my recent comments about Doctor Who showrunner Stephen Moffat and the unfair stuff that gets said about him. I won't go into huge detail here as they largely trod the same ground as past comments I've made here. Suffice to say, the people were tweeting me with agreement about my comments, and there was also some interesting Twitter chat actually on how people who attribute certain characteristics to Stephen Moffat and then think they've spotted them in each and every episode he writes or contributes to, those people ought to stop and think of the company he keeps. Look at Stephen Moffat's mates, people. Think of Neil Gaiman, Mark Gatiss, people like that. If you think his mates would put up with X behavior or Y attitude from anyone they come across, let alone Stephen Moffat, you're nuts. Yet there are people out there who have never met Moffat at all, but they think they know best. They think they know him. I find it quite humorous. There's just no way you'll bring some of them back to reality, honestly. Mute or block tend to be the best options. All right, this is a massive episode with a lot of cool content, so let's get into it. But before we do, remember, folks, we welcome comments on Twitter, email, Facebook, or even MP3s. Why not record yourself and we'll use that on the show? I love hearing people ask questions or make comments in their own voice on podcasts. Go for it. Don't be shy. Details on how to be in touch are at the end of the show. And now, it's time for my top stories of the week. Alrighty, time for my top stories of the week. And as in past episodes, I'll start with the Star Wars Episode 7 rumours. But before I do, as always, this is spoilerific. And in particular this week, I'm going to talk about a rumour that just got everyone very flustered this week and freaking out and feeling that they'd been completely spoiled and they needed to go and, you know, wash their eyeballs with soap and water after they saw it and all of this crazy stuff, none of which I actually felt. Then again, I'm not really a, you know, spoiler phobic kind of person, so it's kind of hard for me to judge. But at the same time, a lot of this stuff we talk about as rumors are very much rumors and speculation and, you know, people looking at concept art and making inferences, and, you know, it's not quite the spoiler that you'd come across if someone had actually seen the finished movie and was telling you about it. So, as always, yes, I'm about to go through some spoilers. Yes, you might be one of those people who absolutely freaks out when you hear, you know, a rumor of some kind. I was trying to think of something, like, really minor that someone might freak out about. But that doesn't matter. Look, if you're very spoiler phobic, please just fast forward to the next section of the show. You can look at the show notes to see what the timings are, and you'll miss everything I'm about to say if that's what you want. I'm really drawing this out because the rumor I'm going to talk about has freaked out a lot of people. It's not just minor stuff like, you know, some spy photos and, oh, we saw the Millennium Falcon or anything like that. It's big stuff, if it's true. So I think that's pretty good warning. So please fast forward because I'm about to rip right into it. Alrighty. Now, one of the big rumors this week came through the Making Star Wars website. And as USA Today has said in a story today, of all days, about the story, it says, "The idea," this is the rumor we're about to talk about, "is haphazardly laid out by Making Star Wars with equal parts regret, enthusiasm, and doubt. It's based on concept art and conspiracy theories, all of which are encapsulated with the line, 'This is the way the wind appears to be blowing right now.'" I couldn't have said it any better than that, which is why I've just read the USA Today intro to the story. And yeah, let's talk about it. The rumor is Luke Skywalker could be the big bad of Episode 7. It could be the case that the Daisy Ridley character is searching for Luke Skywalker throughout the film, and at the end of the film she comes across Luke Skywalker, who has his Return of the Jedi cloak on, apparently. Yes, all these years later, apparently. And he has a red cyborg eye. At least one of his eyes is red. And he's a bad guy. And there's something about Darth Vader's burnt-up mask. All kinds of stuff. Now, people have freaked out at this. They've freaked out that Luke Skywalker's the bad guy. My initial reaction, meanwhile, was, oh, that's interesting. I thought the whole gist at the end of Return of the Jedi was that he faced his biggest obstacle. He defeated it. why 30 years down the track would he suddenly be a bad guy? Where did this cyborg eye come from? To me, Daisy Ridley might have come across a Luke Skywalker cyborg. It's not actually Luke Skywalker, it's a robot done up to look like him. And so maybe the shock is initially we think, oh my god, it's Luke Skywalker and he's turned bad, but it's only a robot. You know, that's how it came across to me, and in that sense, it's not that big a spoiler. You know, if it's not Luke actually having gone to the dark side, if it's just a robot pretending to be Luke, and we quickly work out that it's only a robot pretending to be Luke, I'm not sure that's such a big deal. If indeed that's the case at all. I mean, there's been update upon update to this rumor, because again, it's all concept art that this is being based off of. People are assuming, well, that's Luke, and he's holding Vader's mask, and he's looking very sad looking at this mask. I mean, they're inferring emotions even from this concept artwork. And, you know, I guess you can do that in some instances, but maybe you can also read in stuff that's not really there. Maybe you can be looking at a character who's not that character at all. Maybe. You know, it's a lot of maybes. So, yes, that was the big rumor this week, that Luke is the big bad. I don't believe it myself, because I don't think it jives with the character. I don't think, particularly as George Lucas sketched out this story, and I don't think George Lucas ever, you know, expected Luke Skywalker to go that way, that he would have written that into the story. I don't think he would have approved of it being written either after he handed in his storyline. I'm not seeing a lot of truth in it being Luke Skywalker being the big bad, but possibly a robot that looks like Luke Skywalker. And that would be a very cool role for Mark Hamill to play. Sort of like a Terminator version of Luke Skywalker, maybe. Who knows? Anyway, moving on. Another rumor, well, not quite a rumor, because this did actually happen. John Boyega and Daisy Ridley both left Twitter. They'd, you know, built up a good following on Twitter, and John Boyega had a pretty good Instagram, as I seem to recall, as well. And all of a sudden, it's just stopped. This had been a good source for, you know, tidbits of information. They certainly hadn't given anything away about Star Wars Episode 7. We'd even talked in past weeks about, you know, Daisy Ridley talking about hanging out with Carrie Fisher and her daughter and their dog. And, you know, John Boyega had put up some interesting stuff. But again, nothing that would give the game away. So I don't know what's happened here. I don't know whether J.J. Abrams has sort of said, hey guys, concentrate more on the film perhaps rather than social media. You know, kind of like what happened to some of our Olympic athletes at the last Olympics. They were told that by their coaches. Maybe both of them were just having a conversation one morning and were talking about, I don't know, maybe they got bullied or got stupid comments on Twitter, and maybe they made a pact to leave Twitter together. Maybe. Who knows? I just made that up. But maybe that happened. Maybe they both decided independently of one another and it just so happened to happen in the same week. You know, you just don't know with this stuff. All we do know is that John Boyega and Daisy Ridley are no longer on Twitter. And that's a shame, because I think most people enjoyed what they had to say. And it did seem that John and Daisy enjoyed what they were doing on Twitter too. So, oh well, that's that. Maybe they'll come back to Twitter after the movie's done. There was an interesting piece of text out there on the internet this week, also on the Making Star Wars website, talking about a deserted, well, destroyed, I should say, AT-AT walker, or AT-AT walker, as some people might like to say, in a desert environment with a young girl living in it. I'll read the description. It's quite short. It says, on a desert planet, there's a canyon, sandy and brown. In front of the canyon is a downed AT-AT walker laying on its side. A young girl sits atop of the mechanical beast's head. She gazes outward towards the end of the canyon, where her hopes and dreams may one day be realized, not unlike Luke Skywalker, yearning for more from his mundane life. For now, this is her home, the wreckage of years of intergalactic warfare. The legs of the AT-AT are partially obscured by sand at the ankles, but pop out at the feet. This walker has been there for some time, and nature has begun to take the machine into the earth. Blah, 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 blah. So people have been speculating that this is the Daisy Ridley character, or Kira. Now, the first thing I think when people say that is, are you sure? Because I've been thinking all along that Kira is possibly the daughter of Han Solo and Princess Leia. Now, if she's the daughter of Han Solo and Princess Leia, why would she be living out in the desert in an AT-AT? Unless she's had a hell of a fight with her parents and decided to run away and live there, perhaps. or maybe it's not Kira living here at all. Maybe it's one of the other female members of the ensemble. But all signs do sort of point to Kira, but it doesn't fit in with the Han and Leia thing, as I just mentioned, so I'm not sure how much faith to put in this rumour either. Is the desert planet Tatooine? Is it somewhere else? Who knows? It's all very interesting when stuff like this comes in. You sometimes wonder, is this someone sitting at home writing something that's the equivalent of fan fiction, or is there a bit of truth to it, or what? I mean, we can take it as an interesting piece of creative writing, and it might mean something, or it might not. I found it interesting. I found it quite a funny sort of place for someone to live. Maybe someone who's played a bit too much Star Wars Galaxies back in the day had decided to write this. Who knows? Who knows? Anyway, moving on. The next piece isn't so much a rumour. This is from MTV, and it's about the Zack Snyder and J.J. Abrams rivalry. And Ben Affleck, the star of Batman vs. Superman Dawn of Justice, has come forward and said that this rivalry is all his fault. He says, "I think it started because J.J. and Colin Anderson, who is a great camera operator, who always works on my movies, and J.J. is always trying to steal, and I'm trying to steal back, sent me a picture of two of them wearing cheap Batman masks. I showed it to Zack, and I said, 'This is BS.'" He didn't say BS, he said the other word. But he says, "This is BS, we have to do something." Zack had the means at his disposal to retaliate with appropriately art-directed stuff, stormtroopers getting stuffed into cars by the Gotham Police Department and stuff like that. Of course, Team Star Wars retaliated with a picture of the Batmobile hidden in the Millennium Falcon, and the joy this is bringing fans of both franchises worldwide hasn't been lost on Batfleck, as he's now being called by MTV, it seems. Affleck says, "It's fun. I think it's cool. It's a weird thing, the sort of meta-awareness of these movies and the two directors going back and forth. I like it. It's cool." So there you go. Ben Affleck, or Batfleck, has decided that this rivalry is all his fault. So if you want to blame someone, blame him. Moving on, I don't know if you play many iOS-type games or Android-type games, but it looks like Disney has, cancelled two of the smaller games that are out there. One's called Tiny Death Star, and one's called Star Wars Assault Team. I think I might have Star Wars Assault Team on my iPad. I'm not sure. I might have to go and check. It seems that they've both been laid to rest, however. I guess people who have already invested money in them or downloaded them can still play them, but it seems that they won't be there anymore for new people to go and pick up. And speaking with Pocket Gamer, there's a chap from Nimblebit who made these games. His name's Ian Marsh, and he says he wasn't even told about Disney's decision to pull the plug before it happened. His quote there to them is, "My assumption is they don't feel it's worth it to maintain the game any longer." On top of that, it was apparently a significant source of revenue for Nimblebit, and so Ian says it stings a little bit more. So that's a shame. If any of you out there were actually playing these games, Tiny Death Star or Star Wars Assault Team, it seems while you might still be able to play going forward, there won't be new people coming to the games, or if you have a friend who wants to play with you, if they can do that, I'm not too sure about how these games work, they won't be able to download it. The games are gone. So, sad news. Moving on to some Doctor Who news now. Doctor Who fans have got a bit of a blast from the past with a new promo video this week. It seems that the Doctor Who Experience in Cardiff, which is a museum of Doctor Who props and costumes and all sorts of good stuff, is reopening. They must have done some redecorating or something. I'm not too up on what's been happening there. But it's reopening, and it's got a new interactive adventure that people can do when they're in there, featuring the 12th Doctor, Peter Capaldi. And to sort of celebrate this, there's a video that's out there on the web at the moment, and it's really interesting, not only because we see Peter Capaldi in like the Hartnell TARDIS control room and other control rooms, and sort of get a sense that you probably follow him around and have some sort of adventure, but there's a female voice at the very start of the video. And the voice says, "I speak to you from the final days of Gallifrey. I am the past you have forgotten. You are the future I will not live to see." Now, that's a bit cryptic, but the voice, a lot of people are saying, is Lala Ward, who played the second incarnation of Romana in the 70s adventures with Tom Baker. And perhaps Romana is talking to us from the Time War. She's looking forward to the future, a future she won't see because she's in the Time War. And wow, wouldn't that be cool if you're there at the Doctor Who experience and somehow it goes into the Time War? I'm really looking forward to someone going down there and going through this now to see if Lala Ward is playing Romana in this adventure or quite how she fits in. It's a very interesting thing. I'll put the link to the video in the show notes so you can go and have a listen yourself if you haven't already heard it. Also in Doctor Who news this week, at the New York City Comic Con, Titan Comics are releasing Doctor Who The 12th Doctor number 1. Now, this is their third Doctor Who comic. They've already got a 10th Doctor and 11th Doctor range. In fact, we've got an 11th Doctor comic review later in this episode. And now we're going to have the 12th Doctor range coming out. The blurb for it says, offering shocks, surprises, and galaxy-shaking revelations, seasoned TARDIS pilot Robbie Morrison, who some of you might know for Drowntown, The Authority, 2000 AD, and Nikolai Dante, and New York Times bestselling artist Dave Taylor, who has done Batman Death by Design and also 2000 AD, mark the start of their first five-issue run by diving headfirst into the console room and pulling all the levers they can, spinning the new Doctor off to his most challenging destination yet. I don't know whether this Capaldi Doctor in the comics will have a new companion rather than Clara. It's often common in comics for the Doctors to have non-TV companions, so it'll be interesting to see who they have adventuring with him. Also at New York City Comic Con, they'll be re-releasing the 10th and 11th Doctor comic number 1 editions. They're the ones that came out a month or two back, with new variant covers for the show. Yes, new variant covers for those issues, which, if you're a comic fan, you'll know that 10th Doctor number 1 and 11th Doctor number 1 had insane amounts of variant covers, and now there's going to be another one added to that collection. So if you've already collected them all, you've still got another one to collect. So get out there to the New York City Comic Con, or find a friendly eBay person who might sell you one, because there's going to be some cool stuff coming out of that. We'll finish this week with a piece of news that's neither Star Wars or Doctor Who, but it is quite related to Doctor Who, and that's that there's currently a Kickstarter for a Minister of Chance video. Now, you may know the Minister of Chance as a character who was in a Seventh Doctor audio, which was out around 2001, if I recall. It was called Death Comes to Time. It was quite a strange story because it really went very dark and actually killed off the Doctor. This was the Seventh Doctor. And it's now regarded as non-canon. I mean, gosh, Doctor Who canon's a mess as it is, but this is absolutely non-canon because it kills off the Seventh Doctor, whereas, as we know, we've seen the Seventh Doctor on screen regenerate into the Eighth Doctor, and anything that happens on screen would supersede, and, you know, a mere audio from when the show was no longer on television back in the early 2000s. So it's not a canon story, but it is a Doctor Who story, and a lot of Doctor Who fans quite like it. And anyway, this character, the Minister of Chance, was in Death Comes to Time, originally played by Stephen Fry, of all people, and then was spun off into some audio adventures, not starring Stephen Fry. They regenerated the Minister of Chance, he became a different guy, and now they're trying to do this video version. And the video version has Sylvester McCoy in it, it has Paul McGann, it has, you know, some interesting English actors in it, Tamsin Grieg, for example, and others. The video they've got up makes it look a little bit budget, like some people have gone out with, you know, some prosumer cameras and filmed some stuff. I'm hoping what they turn out in the end looks a bit better. What they're looking for is about £100,000. They're, I think, 26 or 27 days to go, and they've already got about £20,000. I get the sense they might make this £100,000. They might make more. So if you're a Doctor Who fan from the wilderness years when the show wasn't on TV, and you remember Death Comes to Time, and you remember the Minister of Chance, and you'd like to see a spin-off, they can't explicitly say on the Kickstarter that how it's a Doctor Who spin-off or any of that stuff, but I think Doctor Who fans know where this character comes from and who he is. So, look, if you're into that sort of thing, jump over to Kickstarter. You'll find it pretty easily. kick in a little bit of money or a lot, whatever you like, and get some cool rewards. At the very least, if you kick in a decent amount, you should be able to stream the episode when it comes out and watch it online. There are lots of other cool rewards as well if you want to throw in more money. So, very, very interesting. Minister of Chance. Anyway, that's it for my top stories of the week. Hope you enjoyed them. If you've got any questions about them, please write in. If you've got any comments, please do likewise. And now it's time to find out who is Missy. Alright then, so as any self-respecting Doctor Who fan at present watching Series 8 knows, we have this mysterious character called Missy, who has appeared at the end of several episodes. She is in charge of Heaven, or the Afterlife, or the Nethersphere, whatever you might want to call it, and she seems quite genial and happy with the characters she's met, characters who have been bumped off in the episodes we've been watching. She's welcomed them to Heaven, and it's all seemed quite jolly. But who is this character? We know from spy photography, and even official photography the BBC has put out, as far as I'm aware, that the Doctor, you know, meets her face-to-face towards the end of the series, possibly the last two episodes. And it's got a lot of people wondering, who is she? And like Star Wars Episode 7 rumours, there's a lot of thoughts going around, people who think they know, people who are just having a good guess, and a lot of speculation, and I thought it might be fun to try and collect together as many of these as I could, and just give my own thoughts on them. Now, I guess the strongest of these rumours is that Missy is a female version of the Master. Now, what are the reasons for this? Well, if the Master was female, I guess he'd be the Mistress, and Missy could be short for Mistress. Also, we last saw the Master in 2010. That's 4 years without one of the Doctor's, you know, greatest adversaries over the 50 years that the show's been going. He first popped up in the Pertwee era and met every other Doctor since. And it's time for a comeback. So could Missy be a female Master? I think so. I think that's entirely possible. But what else are people saying about Missy? Well, others are saying that she's a possible version of Clara. Not the Clara we know, but maybe an alternate dimension Clara. Maybe it was some sort of accident when Clara jumped into the Doctor's time stream and she got zipped off to this other place and, you know, became a different sort of person. That's interesting, but I'm not so sure they'd try and pull that on a mainstream audience because, you know, to us looking at Missy, the actress is not like an older version of Jenna Coleman. I think that just might become too confusing for people to say, oh, this woman who looks nothing like Jenna Coleman is Jenna Coleman from another dimension or another universe or whatever it might be. So I'm less into that concept. I'm not so sure it would be a future version of Clara. I just can't get behind the idea. Another rumour going around is that Missy is the TARDIS. Now, this has come up for a few reasons. Obviously, Missy referred to the Doctor as her boyfriend at one stage, and I guess we could all imagine the TARDIS thinking of the Doctor as being its or her boyfriend. Others have pointed to the way Missy is dressed as being similar to when the TARDIS took on a human form as Idris, but I think that's really just coincidence more than anything. Yet others have pointed to the garden we saw at the end of Deep Breath, and they've said, hey, look, that circular section of the garden that Missy is dancing around is like the central console of the TARDIS, so Missy is the TARDIS. This is on par for me with the Missy is Clara rumour, to be quite honest. I'm not buying into it at all. Then there's the rumour that Missy is an alternate version of River Song. Now, people are picking up on this. Perhaps the Doctor, when he was saying goodbye to River Song at Trenzalore, managed to trap her consciousness, perhaps in a pocket watch, like he trapped his own real personality in a pocket watch once, and maybe he's let it loose into the Nethersphere, where somehow River Song has transformed into this darker character for some reason. And, you know, there's one... It sounds a bit far-fetched, but there's one name-based reason that's floating around out there that has got me sort of biting my lip and thinking, maybe. And that's the way Stephen Moffat has played on Riversong's name in the past. Obviously, talking about the ponds and rivers. And when you think of rivers, some people think of the Mississippi. That's a very famous river. Now, could Missy be short for Mississippi? Maybe. I don't know. It, again, it's very far-fetched. So far out of these rumours we've had so far, the master rumour seems to be the strongest to me, and even then I'm not completely sold on it. So there's that rumour of River Song. Then there's the rumour that Missy could be the Rani. Now, this rumour comes up every time we have a new series of Doctor Who coming and we hear that there's a female adversary or an interesting female coming up in an episode. People are like, oh, it's the Rani! And, you know, the Rani was only ever in two Doctor Who stories, a Colin Baker story and a Sylvester McCoy story. And, you know, in both of those stories wasn't entirely interesting. She was better in Mark of the Rani than she was in Time in the Rani, that's for sure, but at the same time still not completely interesting, never really fleshed out. A lot of old school fans still cling to the hope, though, that the Rani will come back to Doctor Who one day, and I guess she's, you know, she's better than inventing someone new, because we have the Master, then we have the Rani. You know, if they're going to bring someone back to be that, maybe she should be the Rani. Or what about Romana? Obviously, the Doctor left Romana in E-Space. Since then, of course, Romana's popped up in many Big Finish audios, but the show doesn't have to adhere to Big Finish audios. Could it be a new regeneration of Romana? You know, she adventured with the Doctor in two incarnations. She might refer to the Doctor as her boyfriend, maybe? It's a bit of a stretch. So, these female Time Lord rumours, the Rani, maybe Romana, almost as strong as the Master rumour, but still nothing's beating that for me so far. And then probably the final big rumour that's going around is that Missy is God, or what someone's interpretation of God might be, or possibly she is Death. You know, she's dressed in black, she's in charge of the Nether Sphere, it's where people go when they die. Is Missy Death? Will the Doctor be fighting Death in the last two episodes of this series? That's quite a compelling kind of thing, and it doesn't rely on Missy being the Master or the Rani or River Song or Romana or, you know, an alternate Clara or anything like that. It's literally a character who's been in fiction and storytelling since time immemorial. You know, this concept of God or a God or Death. I think that's possibly the strongest out of all the rumours so far. It's maybe not the most interesting in some ways, but it's possibly the strongest. Anyway, what do you think? Sitting there at home or sitting in your car on the way to work, maybe you're on a bus or a train or waiting at an airport. Wherever you are, please pull out your phone or your tablet and tap me a little message to hello@whowars.net or drop me an MP3, whatever you'd like. Write me a tweet and let me know what you think. Who do you think Missy is? It's a great mystery, and I think it's one of the fun mysteries. I think it's one of the more fun mysteries we've had in recent series of Doctor Who. I'm quite into it. She's a very interesting character. Obviously, she's in charge of this place that looks very interesting. Is it really the afterlife? Well, I mean, a lot of people don't even believe in the afterlife. So I wonder if the Doctor Who team writing this is going to really push the story in the direction of a place that a lot of people out there don't even believe in. Or will they pull it back a bit and it's not really what we think? It's not really heaven or what some people out there would interpret as heaven. It's not really the afterlife. Maybe it's this thing called the Nether Sphere that gets mistaken for those things. I don't know. I'm sure it will be very, very interesting finding out. Please drop me a line and let me know what you think. I'm interested to hear more opinions than just my own on this. Let me know. All right, then, we come to a part of the show where I'm going to talk about something that it feels like I've been talking about forever, not just here on the Who Wars podcast, but on my previous podcast, The Comic Book Show, and even before I had that podcast, you know, just talking to friends and family about it, and that is Star Wars Rebels. At long last, Star Wars Rebels Spark of Rebellion, the 1 hour opening episode of the series, was screened on Australian cable television on Foxtel, as we have down here, on Friday, the 3rd of October. And interestingly, that means it went out ahead of the premiere screening in the US. Obviously, a lot of people in the US had already seen it. I think there'd been some special deal. If people had a particular Disney Channel, they could watch it on their iPads or something earlier. And obviously, there are a lot of test screenings as well. So a lot of people had seen it. But in terms of the actual premiere on US cable, we actually got it here first in Australia, just because of the time difference. Going forward, that's not going to happen. It'll be screened in the US, I believe, on Monday nights, and it won't be screened here in Australia until Friday of that same week. So the US has days and days advantage on us there. But this first episode, yes, we did have it first. But I digress. I've been talking about it coming for a long time. I've read A New Dawn, you know, the first of the new Star Wars canon novels that has the characters from Star Wars Rebels, well, at least some of them, in it. And now I've finally seen it. And all these people who have seen it before me at Comic-Con and, you know, alluded to different things, I now know what you people were talking about. And I guess the first place to start is by saying that everyone's perception of Star Wars is different. I think it really depends on what age you were when you first saw it, which of the movies you first saw, whether they're the original trilogy or the prequels. Gosh, there are so many variables around it, whether you maybe had older siblings who are into it and kind of, you know, I think when an older sibling's into something, you want to be into it too, and you sort of get sucked in that way. You know, other people might have came to it of their own choosing, and on it goes. And this means that these great movies that we all talk about in a similar way and with a similar language, we are also seeing differently to some degree as well. And I don't think we always appreciate that when, you know, I might talk to someone 15 years younger than myself about Star Wars. I think we're talking about the same thing, but really we're looking at two slightly different things, like a picture that's slightly out of focus, because just our life experiences and where we saw these things and, you know, what we did around those movies at the time is just completely different to each other. So, with that preamble out of the way, you'll understand why I was saying it now when I want to comment that the setting for Star Wars Rebels is right, and the characters are right. And by right, I mean right for me. The setting here, 5 years before A New Hope, is to me what Star Wars is. Obviously, Star Wars is much bigger than that in terms of the whole universe, you know, thousands, even hundreds of thousands of years old. But to me, that setting of the original movies, you know, give or take 5 years on either side, is what I grew up with, is what I always knew as Star Wars before any expanded universe or prequels came along. So to step back into that universe with Rebels, you know, sitting in a comfortable armchair, my wife in another comfortable armchair by my side, both watching it, I didn't feel that I was going to cry, but I felt a surge of emotion inside myself. I hope, you know, you folk listening out there did as well, because it was quite a nice, profound sort of feeling that somehow I was stepping back into a universe I hadn't seen for a long time. Even though I've read novels set in it, even though I've played computer games that have touched on that era in the past, here I'm sitting watching brand new Star Wars content that is 100% canon, and it's in this universe that I know and love and feels like, you know, an old pair of slippers that I've just slipped on for the evening. The setting could not be more right for me. And as I said, the characters are right too. You know, to look at this crew of this ship, you know, a light looks like Corellian freighter of some kind. It's got, you know, some Millennium Falcon type cues in its design, so I'm pretty sure it's a Corellian type ship. And the people in it, a diverse bunch. And even the Jedi is wearing a sidearm. He's wearing a blaster on his hip as well. Speaking of the Jedi, I felt that although there's a lot of Jedi content in the story, you know, there's a holocron and Kanan does his big reveal to Imperial troops when he stands up with his lightsaber lit and takes them all on, you know, he asks Ezra to come and train with him because Ezra's obviously powerful in the Force. Despite all of that, it didn't feel like a Jedi-focused episode, and I'm really hoping that vibe continues in Star Wars Rebels, that it's not a Jedi-focused show, even though Kanan is a Jedi, and it looks like Ezra would train up to be a Jedi. I guess one of the things about the Clone Wars series that I didn't like so much was the focus on Jedi. That might seem weird from a Star Wars fan, but I've always been more interested in the Han Solo types and people getting along in the universe without superpowers. I mean, to go off on a real tangent here, when I look at the superheroes I like your superheroes who don't have superpowers of their own. Batman doesn't have superpowers. You know, he's a great martial artist and he has a lot of, you know, great costumes and machinery around him. Same with Iron Man. He has no special powers. He just has a lot of money. He's a genius developer and so on. I always gravitate more towards the people who are ordinary, but who, you know, take that and put a spin on it and do something extraordinary with their lives. So you might think that for that reason I wouldn't like the Kanan character or as well. No, that's not the case. I do like them very much, but I'm just saying that there wasn't, to me, a huge focus on them. You know, we got a good taste of everyone on this ship, of Zeb Aurelius, of Chopper the droid, of Hera, and of Sabine. And I think it was really well balanced. Presumably, as the series goes on, like any series, there'll be episodes where, oh, this is the Sabine episode, this is the Ezra episode, and so on. And I guess in those, if the focus is on a character who is a Jedi, there will be a bit of a Jedi focus there. But here, in this more even kind of episode, if I can put it that way, where there wasn't favoritism to one character or another. I mean, I guess we got a little more Ezra than everyone else, but on the whole, I think everyone got some really good screen time. Yeah, I just really felt that the characters came across as right to me. You know, again, to me, because what I like is those characters without the superpowers. You know, Hera doesn't have superpowers, Sabine doesn't, Zeb Aurelius doesn't. You know, Zeb might be super strong, Sabine might have her artistic skills and her explosive skills. Hera is obviously a great pilot, but none of that is based on the Force. You know, more of that, please. And I guess in this era where there are less Jedi, we're really not going to come across a whole lot of Jedi or a whole lot of Jedi duels all that often. I'm sure they'll happen. I'm sure they'll find a way to make it happen. But I just really like the setting and the characters for those reasons. And then, you know, look, going to the spice mines of Kessel. Who would have thought that was going to come up? I was really happy to finally see, you know, the spice mines of Kessel on the screen. We didn't, of course, get a look inside them or a lot of detail, but we were there. We were in this place that we've heard about, you know, a long, long time ago. And to finally see it, fantastic. And to bring the Wookiees into it, you know, that genius. Everyone loves Wookiees. And obviously it's quite fitting in terms of the lore and everything we've known about Star Wars in the past that there would be Wookiees taken as slaves and sent there to those spice mines. And yeah, look, it was fantastic to see them. I think that young Wookiee, I can't think of his name off the top of my head, I've only seen the episode once, he'll obviously be a bit of a favourite with the kids out there. Maybe they'll make an action figure of him, maybe a plushie. I think that'll go down very, very well. So at this point, you might feel that I'm just, you know, gushing and just so, so happy with Rebels. And, you know, to be honest, you're pretty much on the money. I felt that was pretty flawless for the kind of entertainment that Rebels is. And again, for me and what I like in my Star Wars, I think it just pretty much nailed it. I mean, yeah, sure, some of the, I guess, the messages and the motivations for the characters were laid on a little thick. You know, but I guess that's for the younger ones to grasp it, you know, but I'm not sure they need it so laid on as it was, you know, the way Ezra was saying, you know, no one goes back for others and no one helps others. And oh gosh, now I'm helping someone. And, you know, it was just laid on a teeny bit thick, but you know, that's not even a complaint. That's more just an observation and an understanding that it's there for the younger folks in the audience. You know, and when that's the worst thing I can say about this, like the real worst thing I can say, you know, I just think this was great. I'm sitting here in front of my microphone in a hot, you know, study here in Sydney, Australia, just over the moon with it. Just really, really over the moon. You know, to go back to the characters again, the whole crew comes across as likable. I try and think of a favourite, and it's like, well, Sabine, you know, she's an awesome Mando, she blows stuff up, she's got a blaster in either hand like Jango Fett, or like some kind of, you know, gunslinger from the Wild West. That's so cool. Oh, but then again, Zeb is very physical, and he's throwing people around like the Hulk. He carries a Wookiee on his shoulder at one time, and I thought, gee, he must be very strong to be doing that. And he has all these great lines, so, you know, Zeb, yeah, cool. But then again, this Ezra kid is just starting on this big journey, and even at his worst, you know, quotation marks worst, when he had no interest in the Ghost crew and what they were doing, and he was doing his own thing, and, you know, all of that, he was still likable, you know, and so on and so forth with all the characters. You know, there's no one jarring, there's no one who comes across as, oh, don't like that character, which is often the case in ensembles. There's always someone you don't like, either because the writers have written them that way, or because they're just all so diverse, you can't like everyone. But here, I really liked everyone in this episode, and I'm sure people will end up with favourites. I will too, I'm sure of that. But right now, sitting here today, you know, within 24 hours of first seeing the episode, I'd find it very hard to say definitively who I liked best, or even who I think I'll like best over time. I'm not even sure I can guess, because I'm sure Ezra's journey will be quite interesting, but I'm sure Kanan's got a lot to do, and I'm sure Hera's not going to be, you know, a slouch with the way she pilots the ship. You know, Sabine, well, we see her spray painting sort of a prototype rebellion logo on things and blowing stuff up. That will never get old. You know, and on it goes. I really can't even tell you who I think I'll like, you know, as a favourite long term. Maybe I'll be sitting here in 6 months' time saying, you know, I still really like everyone equally. And it might seem like such a cop-out, but as I sit here today, that is absolutely true. Overall, the hour of the episode went by very, very fast, and I'm already thinking that if a regular episode is only 30 minutes, and if they're written to the same standard as that first episode, a 30-minute episode next week is going to feel like, I don't know, maybe 10 minutes. Because the hour just rocketed by. The hour felt like half an hour. It was amazing. It was like, as I've said in another podcast I recorded recently, when I first saw Lord of the Rings, I came out of it and someone said, gosh, we were in there almost for 3 hours. And I was like, oh, really? That felt like an hour and a half. You know, and I think when entertainment is good and well-paced and you're really, really into it, you don't notice the time going by. And that was certainly the case with me watching Rebels. You know, overall, gosh, I'm very, very, very impressed. Unlike Clone Wars, this has me hooked right out of the gate. I watched, you know, the first episode of Clone Wars and I was like, oh, this isn't for me. But I'll try again next week. This isn't for me, but I'll try again next week. And I did that for a couple of seasons until I really started to fall away with watching it regularly by the third season and just gave up after that. As I often say on this podcast, though, I am going to go back to Clone Wars and give it another go from start to finish because I know it gets better. And Kate, who contributes here to the podcast, has suggested actually watching it in chronological order rather than the episode order as they were transmitted. So that's another piece of advice I'm going to take as well. But anyway, I'm getting diverted. The reason I mentioned Clone Wars is that I'm pretty much the same guy I am now as when I started watching Clone Wars. You know, I'm already an adult. I've already got a lot of Star Wars miles under the belt. So I feel that my thought process is very similar. And Clone Wars just didn't grab me at all. And here I sit today, the same person, with the same thought processes, same interests, same likes, same dislikes. And Star Wars Rebels has just reached out and grabbed me. And, you know, without trying to be hammy, said, come here, come home, come back to the Star Wars that you remember when you were a kid and vehicles you remember from when you were a kid. And just everything about it is giving me not just the sense of being a kid, but just feeling, as I said earlier, very, very comfortable, like an old pair of slippers. And I cannot wait for next week's episode. I'm just blown away by everything to do with this. I'm blown away by the fact they're showing the lead characters shooting stormtroopers dead. Well, to me, they're shooting them dead. I mean, they're not using stun rays. They're not using those blue stun rays. They're using live real blaster bolts, and they're knocking these stormtroopers down. They're killing them. This isn't shooting battle droids or slicing up battle droids. This is killing real people in stormtrooper armor. I'm surprised, pleasantly surprised, to see that in a, quotation marks, children's cartoon. And long may it continue. I think this is the kind of action and adventure that kids need. This is the kind of stuff that sucked people of my age and older into the original Star Wars movies when they first came out. It's just amazing. Like Doctor Who, you know, people who grew up with Star Wars are now running the place, same with Doctor Who, and I think they really get what Star Wars is all about, and long may this continue. You know, I've said in the past I can see this going for 4 or 5 seasons, and I think that might be their intent by starting it, you know, 5 years before A New Hope. So, fingers crossed the ratings are good. We've already got a second season greenlit already. So we're almost halfway there to those 5 seasons, once that second season's out of the way. Yeah. Look, I've rambled here. I've just sat here and just stream of consciousness into the microphone, but I hope you can tell that it's real, it's genuine. I'm a guy pushing 40. I've just watched this, quotation marks, kids show, and I had a fantastic time. I hope you do too, if you've not seen it. But if you have seen it, what did you think? Do you agree with me? Do you see Star Wars the same as me in terms of, you know, age and where you first saw it and so on? Or are you a newer fan? What are your perceptions? I'd love you to write to me, send me an MP3, whatever you like, and we'll get it on the show next week. All right, thanks for listening. Next week, we'll review the first of the 30-minute regular episodes of Star Wars Rebels. Hopefully, I'll have a co-pilot along for that, so we can chat about what we saw and what we thought. Who knows? Until then, may the Force be with you. I've always wanted to say that.
Hey everyone, it's me again. I hope you've enjoyed hearing from the correspondents that have been added to the Who Wars show. One of the great things about being in a fandom like Star Wars is hearing from people with various thoughts or opinions. We all have this common bond, but new or different perspectives can really help to broaden our appreciation and make us love our fandom even more. Do you have something to say that you'd like other fans to hear? Especially along the Star Wars side of things? Rob is still looking for people to join the Who Wars team. You don't need any podcasting experience, just a voice and a microphone. So if this is something that sounds interesting to you, drop Rob a line. You can reach him at hello@whowars.net.
All right then, now it's time to look at the Doctor Who episode that screened this week, screened earlier this morning in Australia, simulcast with the UK, and the name of that episode was Kill the Moon. Obviously there are spoilers ahead, so if you've not seen it, I wouldn't really listen to this review. And look, before I begin, if you've listened to the last few episodes of this podcast, you'll know that my introductory remarks for a few episodes now have been talking about showrunner Stephen Moffat and some of the silly, despicable, nutty type remarks that get made about him online on social media. Things that have nothing to do with Doctor Who or what he's written or what he's overseen as showrunner, but personal attacks, things about his character, things that these people who make the attacks couldn't even know about him. They just infer them and then think they start seeing patterns in the show, and you know, they make their little checkboxes and sit there each episode going, oh, he did that, he did that, oh, and ha ha, he did that, I got him, I got him. And it's like, oh my God, you know, people, get a life. But in all of that, I've been very clear that if someone has a beef with something Stephen Moffat has actually written or done to the show, then that's fair game. That's TV criticism. That's completely normal. You know, it's when people take it into the personal and start criticizing him for some personal characteristic that they either see or they perceive because of something he's written. That's just weird. This episode, I felt, was disappointing. I felt it was disappointing on several levels, and I'll try and get to them as I project this stream of consciousness into the microphone. I think with this episode, Moffat, as the showrunner, has seriously misjudged the audience. I think Stephen Moffat has a theory on companions. Well, I don't think this. I know this because he has said it in several things I've seen before. He thinks the companions are the focal point of the show. And that goes back to a very old theory. you know, an old theory that the companions are our window into the series. The Doctor is obviously an alien. Having humans travel with him is our touchstone, our reference point. Through them, we get the adventure. You know, in the olden days, the saying was, the companions ask the questions that we might want to ask so we can know the answers, because the Doctor would already know the answers to half the stuff that comes up. But with a human companion who doesn't know saying, Doctor, what does this do? Doctor, what is that alien? The Doctor can explain it, and that's how we learn things. Stephen Moffat, however, is taking this very, very far. He's got this concept ramped up on steroids in the last few series of the show, to the point where a common complaint, even back in the Matt Smith era, was that the show should have been called The Amy Pond Show, because the Doctor was doing so little, relatively speaking. It was all about Amy Pond, and what Amy Pond thought, and what Amy Pond did. You know, that was driving a lot of fans nuts, and I got that. I didn't actually even like the Amy Pond character, so it was a double whammy for me. Not only had the character of the companion overtaken the show and, you know, pushed the Doctor aside, but it was someone I didn't even like. So I get you, people. I get you. It was a double whammy for me, as I say. And here, in this episode, we see Clara continuing to bully, overpower, basically take over the show and make it all about her. Now, I think there's a reason for this, and we'll get to that in a minute, but it is making the show very hard to watch at times. And in some ways, it's remarkable that I've managed to get through all the episodes to date and feel relatively good about the show. But in this one, it sort of tipped me over the edge a bit. Now, I think that's probably enough introduction. Let's get into it. I guess this episode started with the premise of Courtney not being special. This is something the Doctor has allegedly said to her. And Clara takes him up on this in a very aggressive way. You know, to the point where she confronts him in the TARDIS about it. You know, you said she wasn't special. And she stands there with her arms crossed. You know, this really defiant, I'm in charge kind of body language. And I'm just thinking, who are you? Like, if the Doctor's thrown a throwaway line to Courtney that she's not special, then maybe she's not special. You know, not everyone is. It reminds me of how in schools these days, everyone gets an award for participation in things to make everyone feel good about themselves. And I'm really not sure what kind of people that is eventually raising. There are winners and losers in life. It's a fact. And, gosh, I could go down a real rabbit hole talking about that. Let's extract ourselves from that rabbit hole and continue on with the episode. The premise that the moon was an egg was interesting, but silly. I mean, come on, this concept that this big stone thing up there in the sky for 100 billion years was just an egg waiting to hatch. What a strange life form. What an unbelievable life form. And although we're talking about a show that's full of strange and unbelievable things, that was really, really pushing things. And then, if we can skip forward to the end, that this thing can hatch and just fly away happily, and then lay an egg instantly to become the new moon. This is the kind of stuff that a non-Doctor Who fan upon hearing would really laugh at. And I know we don't often care about people from other IPs laughing at our stuff, because, hey, we could go and laugh at, you know, things in Star Trek or things in other series. So we shouldn't get too worried about that, but it was a silly concept. Up there on the moon, though, it did look very cool. This was the Lanzarote filming, and the Lanzarote volcanic, you know, landscape looked very, very good as the moon. You know, once they'd put in a black sky above them and lit it in a certain way, the setting looked fantastic. You know, I guess people at home who don't know about the Lanzarote filming might think it was some kind of CGI, some sort of special effect. But it really wasn't. That was real ground they were walking around on. That looked really good. And the little parasites themselves up there on the moon, they were well done. The way they killed was, like, really scary. They looked fantastic. And, you know, the episode was trundling along in a way that I thought was, you know, pretty good. There'd been that, you know, defiance and aggressiveness from Clara earlier on, but I'd largely forgotten about that. We're up there on the moon, we're having this adventure. And then, of course, comes the time for Clara and the other two humans up there to make their decision, and the Doctor leaves them to it. You know, in the preview of this episode last week, we were talking about how the Doctor does something that the Doctor's never done before. And there it was. The Doctor just left them to it. He doesn't have a dog in this race. It's your moon. You guys work it out. It's a kind of, you know, when I was looking at what he was doing, I thought this is a real sort of tough love. This is saying, hey guys, make up your mind. You make the decision. You know, for people who criticize this, the Doctor could have done no more. The Doctor would have just been another voice in the mix. And so the Doctor, extracting himself from that mix, just left it down to the three humans to decide. And I thought that was very good. I'm sure there are people out there who'll disagree with that, but I felt that the Doctor saying, hey guys, you make up your own mind, goodbye, and literally leaving in the TARDIS, not even just going into the TARDIS to sit there, but literally removing himself from the action, I thought was really good, really interesting. And of course, in the end, the right decision was made, the creature lived, the Earth was saved, we got a new moon, all was well. The astronaut thanked Clara, and Courtney, at long last, was no longer not special, she was special. She'd done something fantastic. All in all, a fairly standard kind of Doctor Who story, aside from the fact the Doctor left them to make the decision, you know, landing on the moon, some wicked little beasties getting around killing people, saving the day. It was a fairly pedestrian Doctor Who story with a bit of a silly concept at its heart that the moon was an egg. That's it, in a nutshell. But then we get to the end of the episode and what I would really like to talk about here. And that is when Clara absolutely flipped out. Her rant at the end of the episode was bizarre. But there are reasons for this, and I'll get to that in a minute. When she gets aggressive with the Doctor, telling him it's none of his business, actually reaching out and stopping the TARDIS from taking off, telling him, I'll smack you so hard you'll regenerate. Wow. Now, is that okay for her to say to him? I'm just trying to turn that around in my head. If the Doctor said to her, hey, you're being a bit of a pain in the ass, so much so I want to punch you into the middle of next week, would that have been okay? No. People would have been up in arms. Everyone would have been saying, hey, you don't talk to your friends like that. You don't threaten people with violence, whether they're your friends or not. You know, gosh, Doctor, what are you doing? And yet when Clara says to him, I'll smack you so hard you regenerate. Yeah, that's okay, apparently. It's cool. You know. The Doctor remains fairly calm throughout this whole conversation, and maybe that lulls people into the sense that it's okay. But it's really not. If someone comes up to you in real life, and they've got a beef with you, and they threaten you with violence, would you think that's okay? Would you take it? I don't think you would. You might be scared, and you might not want to fight back. But I don't think you'd be happy that someone was doing it to you. So, yeah, look, Clara really ramps up here. But again, the Doctor isn't getting mad at this. He says he has faith in Clara. That's why he left the decision to her. And then she goes on. She comes out with the line, do you have music playing in your head when you say that? Like, what a bitchy thing to say. You know, whether it was a man or a woman saying that, what a bitchy thing to say. This is Clara at her most unlikable, and yet there are people online saying, oh, that was great. You know, the way she talked to the Doctor was great. No, that's not great. That's not how you talk to your friends. Your friend is there very calmly saying how much faith they have in you, how they left things to you because they do believe in you, and all you can do is berate them for it. You want to threaten them with violence. You say bitchy things like, do you hear music playing in your head when you say that? And yet the Doctor remains calm. But you know what? It's not over yet. Then we get an incredibly... it's egomania, is what it is. And I wonder if a lot of people even actually caught this when they watched the episode the first time, because it's quite a confronting scene. There's a lot being said. And if you only watched it once, you might not have really twigged onto this line. You'll twig onto it again, I think, when you watch it a second time or a third time. And that's when Clara shouts at him, don't lump me in with all the other humans you find so tiny and predictable. Let's read that again. Don't lump me in with all the other humans you find so tiny and predictable. Clara doesn't want to be lumped in with all these other humans. Clara doesn't see herself as tiny and predictable. Clara sees herself as something special. Clearly, that's what that line is saying. Now, have you ever heard the term hubris? I think Clara has quite a lot of hubris going on here. I think, you know, when she follows it up with clear off, go on, clear off in your lonely bloody TARDIS, don't come back. Yet the Doctor's still being quite calm and reasonable. Clara is displaying a kind of hubris that, to go back to what I was hinting at earlier, is going to be her downfall, in my opinion. If this isn't setting her up for a big sort of Greek tragedy ending, I'll be really disappointed, because all signs point to that happening. It's the trying to juggle all these lives. It's the lying in the last episode. Even when Danny Pink saw an alien, she was trying to lie and pretend it wasn't real. That's part of a school play. That was a kid in a costume, you know, treating Danny like he was an idiot, threatening violence here to the Doctor, and then saying, don't lump me in with all the other humans you find so tiny and predictable. This is egomania running wild, folks. This is crazy stuff when you stop and think about it. And again, there are people online who think she's great saying all this. I don't think they're really comprehending what's going on. Clara is clearly being set up for a big fall here. She is, you know, rising so high on this hubris of hers. The only way is down. Now, how she actually comes down, I couldn't tell you. Or even if she comes down, there's still a chance that all of this is leading nowhere. But I find it hard to believe that it's leading nowhere when it's just so big. That final scene, you know, that we talked about again last week as being Stephen Moffat's favourite in the whole series, that final scene of Clara just losing it and telling the Doctor to go away and saying these things and slipping in that line about not being lumped in with all the other humans who are so tiny and predictable. This has got to be leading somewhere. It's just got to be. But of course, she then went and had that talk with Danny, and Danny was being quite wise, I think the word used was. And it revealed that, of course, she's not over travelling with the Doctor yet. Danny points out that because she's so angry, she hasn't let go of it. And we know that, of course, because we know Jenna's in the episodes until the end of the year, you know, including the Christmas episode, it seems. So we know Jenna's coming back. We know Jenna and the Doctor will adventure again. And I guess that talk with Danny was in there maybe to reassure people who thought that maybe it wouldn't be the case. I don't know. Again, I can only hope this is all going somewhere, that it sets up the big fall I've been predicting for her, or maybe it turns her into Missy, to go back to the Who is Missy rumours that we did earlier in this episode. And one of the rumours out there is that Missy is somehow an alternate version of Clara. Maybe Clara turns bad, maybe she gets so annoyed with the Doctor that Missy is a manifestation of that. I don't think that's really the case, but who knows? This has got to lead somewhere. Please, Doctor Who production team, this has got to be leading somewhere, because what we saw tonight was quite confronting, and for some quite annoying, for others quite confusing. It's an episode that was going to be very polarizing. People out there who felt they sided with the Doctor, people who felt they sided with Clara. Based on what I'm saying here, clearly I think the right person to be siding with here is the Doctor. The Doctor remained calm all through that exchange. It was Clara threatening the violence. It was Clara saying the egomania stuff. You know, it was Clara, Clara, Clara. The Doctor was saying how much faith he had in her. The Doctor was saying how it was her decision. I think what the Doctor did was interesting. I think it was a bit of tough love, like just removing himself from the scene to allow her to make that choice with the other two. But ultimately, would he have made the difference? That's the real question. For people who think the Doctor should have been there, for people who think the Doctor should have saved the day somehow, well, how would he? How would he have had any more insight into this than Clara? Or Courtney? Or the astronaut? He wouldn't have. As I said at the start of this review, he would have just been another voice in the mix. That's not useful to anyone. So, I feel the Doctor acted interestingly. I think he acted certainly differently in this episode. But did he act wrongly? No. No, I don't think that's something people can throw at him. I don't think that's fair. I think what was wrong was Clara's reaction to him. Maybe it was just it gave her a bit of a scare that she had so much power. But I do think it's more than that. I think it's coming back to all the lying she's done. Clearly the way she sees herself now is more than just another tiny and predictable human. She sees herself as important. You know, I guess she's split herself off into fragments and saved the Doctor all through time. That's got to do strange things to your head, even if that's not being fully explored in the end of the Matt Smith era and now in this era. It's not been explored, but maybe it's starting to come out. Maybe that'll start to be more of the reason behind why she is like she is, why she thinks she's better than other people. Yet I think she's the kind of person who, if you walked up to her in real life, if she was a real life person, and put it to her that she thinks she's better than other people, she would be shocked by that. She'd be taken aback. She wouldn't understand where you were coming from at all. And that's sometimes the way with people who are like this, or people who do bad things but think they're doing good things. You put it to them that they're doing a bad thing, and they don't get where you're coming from. They don't see themselves as doing a bad thing at all. So yeah, interesting times ahead. Interesting times ahead. Anyway, I guess we'll hear next week what Lex thought of this episode. When you hear how she skewered the caretaker, I can only start to imagine what she's going to say about this one. And until next week, I want to do what I did at the end of last episode, which is give you a bit of an episode preview for next week's Mummy on the Orient Express. Now, again, this comes from Doctor Who magazine number 478. If you have that one at home, this is an article in there. It's by Benjamin Cook. And I'll give you a little excerpt to tantalize your taste buds, as it were. Okay. As titles and story pitches go, Mummy on the Orient Express is one heck of a place to start. Surprise, surprise, it was a Stephen Moffat title, laughs writer Jamie Matheson. I'd written Flatline, episode 9 in this series, first. I'd done quite a nice job on my third draft, and then I got a phone call saying, "Got something to offer you. Do you want to do another episode?" Well, of course I do. The title Stephen has in mind is Mummy on the Orient Express, so if you go away and have a think about what you'd do with that title. Immediately it suggested to me Agatha Christie, Victoriana, lots of luxury. I've got a friend who's a big train buff. In fact, his name is Perkins, so I put him in there as Frank Skinner's character, and I sent him an email saying, "I want to pick your brains about the Orient Express," though he had no idea what I was working on. Happily, Jamie made it along to some of the recording of Mummy on the Orient Express, where he met Peter Capaldi, Jenna Coleman, and Frank Skinner. "I used to be a stand-up comic," explains Jamie. "Frank was one of the stand-ups I'd watch back then, trying to learn from. I'd love the progressions from me, aged 26, watching Frank's videos, yep, it was VHS back then, to me, aged 44, writing lines for him in an episode of Doctor Who. I specifically said in the script, in my description of what Perkins is wearing, that he's wearing an old train engineer's outfit with a cap and dungarees, and that's exactly how they dressed him. It's doubly nice because his namesake Perkins, the massive train fan, also does a job where he works on a luxury train as a hobby. I love that my friend Perkins is going to watch this and go, 'That's me, Frank Skinner is me.' Over the centuries, many trains have taken the name Orient Express, but this, claims the Doctor in Jamie's episode, is the only one in space, an utterly faithful recreation of the original, except the rails are actually hyperspace ribbons, and there's a rampaging mummy on board. No biggie. The issue I had in constructing the plot was how do I hide the mummy," says Jamie. "I thought, as soon as the mummy starts killing people, how stupid are the passengers and the Doctor if they can't spot the killer? Do we make it a ghost? Do we make it invisible? Perhaps the bandages could go under doors like snakes and reassemble as the mummy. Could one of the passengers be sort of a Jekyll and Hyde, becoming the mummy at certain times? I had all sorts of ideas until eventually I came up with the solution, which I think is a bit spoilery to reveal here, but it feels, if nothing else, that it's redeemed mummies, because mummies to me have always been not a joke, but always a bit of a ridiculous monster as opposed to vampires, werewolves, or zombies. They're the cool monsters. Mummies always seemed like the poor second cousins, a bit silly and shambling. The thing about the title Mummy on the Orient Express is you think it's going to be a silly romp, and it's so not. From the first death onwards, you're like, oh, this is quite dark. We'll skip forward in the article now towards the end. Prior to Mummy on the Orient Express, Jamie wrote two drafts of Flatline before he knew that Peter Capaldi had been cast as the Doctor. "I knew it wasn't going to be Matt Smith, that's all, so I initially wrote a generic Doctor. When Peter was cast, I had a meeting where Stephen sort of laid out his plan for the Doctor and how he saw his character. I thought, who am I picturing when he's telling me all of this? And it was Gregory House from House, played by Hugh Laurie. So I wrote it. Of course, it's been tweaked and changed since then, as if it was Gregory House in the TARDIS. That was a very good starting point for me anyway. There was something about that. I will do the right thing. I will upset people. I'm a bit sociopathic. I don't give a damn what people think of me. But ultimately, I'm the good guy. And when push comes to shove, I will save lives. So I wrote a third draft of Flatline with that in mind. And that draft got me the gig to write Mummy on the Orient Express. This series, Clara's character has undergone something of a reinvention too. Was that a director from Stephen? Yes, definitely. It was presented initially as Clara is living a double life. She is effectively, not literally, cheating on her boyfriend with the Doctor because she's going off and having adventures that Danny doesn't know about. In fact, the new Doctor has a lovely foil in Clara who is almost his conscience, the person who pulls him up and says, no, you can't do that, that's not allowed. People are making a lot of mileage over the Missy plot and exactly what that's about, but I really think the arcing plot of this season, one of the meatiest things in this season, is the Doctor and Clara's relationship, the richness of that bond between companion and the Doctor, and how they interact with one another, the negotiation of who the Doctor is now, and what Clara means to that. So some interesting points there at the end of that article in Doctor Who magazine, tying back in some ways to what I was talking about in the review of Kill the Moon regarding Clara. Now, overall, Kill the Moon, if I was going to give it a rating out of 10, it's probably a 7 out of 10 or somewhere around that. It was, as I said, a fairly normal, standard Doctor Who story of the week, which probably would have got a 7 out of 10 from me anyway. You know, I don't think it was really 8 out of 10 material. The stuff with Clara I found annoying, but I can see, rather than just reacting in a sort of Pavlovian way to it, I'm going to take a step back and say, hey, I think this is bigger arc. I think this is Clara setting herself up for a big fall. You know, I guess the alternative is that Clara somehow redeems herself and realizes she has become this egomaniac, realizes she does have all this hubris and changes that. I guess that's the other option. That's not quite as interesting. I think I'd like to see Clara really set herself up for a big fall. I think that's dramatic. I think that's interesting. I think that could have an effect on the Doctor. I think that's way better than Clara at the end of the series saying, oh, I was a bit of an egomaniac. Oh, I had this hubris. Oh, I shouldn't have done that. And then I'm better now and walking off. You know, I don't think that's anywhere near as interesting as Clara just getting worse and worse and lying more and more and pushing everyone she loves and who love her away from her. I think that would be much more dramatic. So, hey, let's see where it all goes. Let's see what happens. Mummy on the Orient Express next week. I'll be there. Will you? So, a really nice thing I get to do as producer of the Who Wars podcast is meet a whole bunch of interesting people from around the world. You know, people talk to me all the time, particularly on Twitter. That seems to be the social media of choice for Who Wars listeners. And I don't just get to meet people, I also get to work with them at times too. You know, Kate and Lex, who have been contributing pieces to the last few episodes, are fantastic examples of this. It's such a thrill for me to be able to sit here and get an email from Kate or Lex, and it's an MP3 of something they'd like to have in the next show, and I get to hear their thoughts on a new episode of Doctor Who, or a book that they've read, or whatever it might be. And that form of contribution is just great. I can take those building blocks and slip them into the show I'm producing, and I think it really breaks things up. You don't have to hear everything just from me. But even better than that is when I can actually interact with people like Lex and Kate and some others who are waiting in the wings, just waiting for their chance to come onto the show. And I did that last week. You heard me do the news with Kate, and that was a whole lot of fun to actually, you know, bounce off someone else rather than just reading stories. And today, I took that a step further by getting Lex and Kate and myself together, and we discussed the first 6 episodes of Series 8 of Doctor Who. And I thought it might be fun, because the whole thing goes for about an hour, I thought I might just present that as its own special. So that's going to come out on Wednesday night, this coming Wednesday night at 7 p.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time. We're moving to Daylight Savings this weekend. And in the meantime, however, because I know both Lex and Kate are keen to hear it, and obviously some of you will be too when you've heard what we've done, I've put together just one section from the special, and this is Kate, Lex and myself talking about the Doctor Who episode, The Caretaker. The reason I chose this in particular is that Lex has a caretaker review later in this episode, a solo review that she's done, where she's not too happy with the episode, and here in this audio talking to myself and Kate, she expands a little further on her thoughts about that. So I thought it might be fun to choose that particular section of the special. Obviously, if you like what you hear here, we have this whole special coming where we do all six episodes so far, with an intro talking about our thoughts going into the series, and an outro where we talk about where we think things might go. Obviously, we haven't seen Kill the Moon at the time we recorded this, and even at the time I'm recording this message now, it's coming out within about the next 12 hours. So there might be some profound implications for Clara and other characters from that episode. I have a feeling there might be, actually. So apologies in advance that it doesn't cover that. But if you want to hear our thoughts on the first six episodes, next Wednesday night, 7 p.m. And here's a taste of what you'll hear. Okay. Moving on, The Caretaker. Now, this episode also received positive reviews. I think most of these episodes have this series in terms of the critics, which is good. Richard Beach of the Daily Mirror gave it 4 out of 5, calling it funny, light-hearted, and thoroughly entertaining. He praised Capaldi's comic timing. Simon Brew of Den of Geek said it was arguably one of the best of Series 8. He too praised the comedic elements of the episode and praised Gareth Roberts' storytelling skills. He praised Coleman and Anderson, calling them excellent, and saying it was their best performance of the series. Matt Risley of IGN gave the episode a positive review, praising the characterization of Clara in the current series altogether. He called The Caretaker satisfying, despite the occasional slip into soap opera silliness. So, did we like it? Did we see a fun comedic episode here? Or did it get a bit silly? Was the monster a bit strange? Did it get a bit soap opera-ish? What are our top line thoughts on this episode?
I'm so sorry, but I did not like it. And you'll hear about it later in my review. I hated it. Well, I didn't hate it, but there are parts of it that I definitely hated.
Give us a taste of your review that's coming up later in the episode.
Okay, well, the soap opera aspect. I think Clara was just completely spaztastic. And Danny and the Doctor, too. They have these huge prejudices, it seems, both of them. And it's just so simple-minded, and not why I watch Doctor Who. I couldn't take it. I'm just not interested in that kind of soap opera stuff, and there is too much of it. But hey, there were aspects of it, and I do give it some credit. So, all right? Kate, what did you think?
I liked it. I thought it had some really funny parts. I liked the part, the Matt Smith lookalike was pretty hilarious. And Courtney, it was so funny to see more of her in this one.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I liked it on the whole, but I can see bits that are a bit silly. And I guess the soap opera-ish elements, I've heard people on other podcasts saying, I've got friends who are getting into the show because of that soap opera element, and I think that's very dangerous because I don't think that's going to continue through Doctor Who. I don't think it will continue once Clara leaves the show, which is very soon, by all accounts.
Yeah.
They're going to get into a show, and then next season are like, oh, it's all different again. What happened? It's hard. It's hard when writers are trying to satisfy two different audiences, this soap opera-ish audience and the people who want to watch Doctor Who. So I get where you're coming from, Lex, completely. I probably liked it a little bit more than you, though.
Okay, good. I generally want people to like Doctor Who, so it's okay.
Okay. Now, what do we make of Clara trying to juggle her different lives? She's been doing it all through the series so far, because it really starts to fall apart here, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It sure did. She lost her mind.
Do you think it's a character flaw on her part that she's such a control freak or thinks that she can, you know, balance everything? And why is she trying to balance everything? Why doesn't she just go and, as I always say, have 100 ventures with the Doctor and then come back to Danny?
Yeah, that's what I was wondering.
It's hard to tell. Well, I don't know. Actually, it's been building up for a while, her going back and forth. But in terms of her breaking apart, sort of breaking down as a character, being a control freak, it's kind of been just this episode. So maybe we shouldn't be applying it to the whole grand scheme of things. I don't know. But yeah, she sure does show those signs.
Yeah, I guess I see it in earlier episodes when she tells the Doctor what to do, and she takes control of situations. I see that as being a bit controlling, like maybe an Into the Dalek.
Yeah.
You know, what did we learn today, Doctor? No, Doctor, what did we learn today? You know, like being very assertive.
Yeah, it's not just this episode. It's all of them.
Kate, what did you make of it?
Yeah, like you were saying, I'm just curious why. Why can't she just be honest about things, and especially with Danny and the Doctor? It seems like she's lying to both. Or at least up until this point, she's been lying to them. And just, it'll be interesting to see where this storyline goes. I think you were saying that in your review about something about that, about where it's going to end up.
I hope they do answer that question, why. I hope they give explanations and more depth to her character. They've got such an opportunity here. So let's hope it happens.
I agree. And I should say here, we're all recording this before the next episode of Doctor Who, Kill the Moon. So there might be more information. I believe it's a very Clara-centric episode from everything I've been told and everything I've read. So we may actually learn a lot more about her. And by the time people hear this next Wednesday, they'll be saying, why are you saying this? We've learned blah, blah, and blah. Well, it's because we haven't seen Kill the Moon yet. So apologies for that.
So close. So close to finding out.
We are. We're very close, but it just hasn't screened yet. Okay, now, what did we make of Danny in this episode when he flipped out? The Doctor referred to himself as a Time Lord, and Danny's like, oh, you're a Time Lord. Oh, yes, sir. No, sir. You know, and just started behaving, in my opinion, like an absolute peanut. But what did you make of it?
I think that was an example of Danny having some of his own prejudices himself. Just as bad as the Doctor. I mean, that was immediate. He went right off the bat into this whole spiel against officers, I guess, or just his type.
Yeah. I thought it was pretty weird.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sorry. Still talking?
No.
Okay. So I thought it was weird, the whole interaction, but, you know, the immediate reaction that he had to him saying that he was a Time Lord, is he familiar with Time Lords? Why does he feel that way?
Yeah, I think it was more the title of Lord. He saw it as maybe aristocracy, upper class, maybe that kind of thing in the British sense.
Let's hope so. I don't know. Maybe he did know exactly what a Time Lord was. You don't know. And that somersault that he does at the end was suspiciously athletic.
Well,
for just a maths teacher. So who knows? Maybe he does know all about this space stuff.
That was the next question I jotted down here. You know, what do we make of that somersault? He's in street clothes. He doesn't have much of a runoff, and he does this ridiculous somersault. What did you think when you saw that?
I was actually too distracted by all the drama going on. So that went right under my radar. I didn't even notice that the somersault was extravagantly athletic until afterwards when you mentioned it. So, hey, that is suspicious. It was strange.
It was. Kate?
It was crazy. But yeah, I think you might be onto something with your X-Files super soldier comparison.
Yeah, that's something I threw out on Twitter for people who didn't see it. I was saying, you know, either this was just a really, really silly moment, like we're just meant to believe this regular guy can do this, or there's something more to him, and maybe he's a super soldier, to use this old X-Files story analogy, you know, these super soldiers who could do anything kind of thing. I
think you're right.
Yeah, I want to hope there's something to it, for the simple reason that just having it in there as something a regular guy could do was so unrealistic.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, what is Danny? Where did he learn this? Is he part cyborg? Does he have very powerful mechanical legs? I don't know. You know?
If this isn't explained, you might want to consider lowering your rating, guys. This episode drives me crazy. They better turn that somersault into something, okay? Doctor Who angry fan right here.
Yeah, Lex, if they don't explain the somersault, I will remove one sonic screwdriver.
Thank you. Punishment must be paid.
That's right. Okay, so that was Kate, Lex, and myself talking about the Doctor Who episode from Series 8, The Caretaker. Again, if you like what you heard there, we're doing it for all six episodes next Wednesday night, complete with additional thoughts on Series 8, where it's been, where we think it's going, and all sorts of good stuff. So, yes, please tune in if you're a Doctor Who fan and you want to hear us waxing lyrical about that. All right, then, on to the next segment. Alrighty then, as some of you would know, there's a series of 11th Doctor and also 10th Doctor comic books currently doing the rounds from Titan Comics. They're still in the early stages. We had issue number 3 of the 11th Doctor comic come out this week, and we'll have issue number 3 of the 10th Doctor comic come out next week. I reviewed issue number 1 of the 11th Doctor on my old podcast, The Comic Book Show, and I thought it was a pretty good debut issue. I reviewed issue number 2 on the first episode here of Who Wars, if you want to go back and listen to that, and I thought it was an even better story. And now we're on to issue number 3. I actually think this trumps issue number 1 and 2 put together. This tells an absolutely bonkers, very Doctor Who story that captures the voice and the spirit of the Matt Smith Doctor very, very well. I mean, how's this for an introduction? We're in Mississippi in 1931. Robert Johnson is on stage. He's the guy who apparently, you know, according to folklore, sold his soul to the devil at the crossroads to become really great at guitar and singing, you know, blues music, and died at a very young age, probably in payment to the devil for that deal that he made. Well, he's up on stage, he's got a crowd in front of him, and there's a young boy, you know, who's going to go on next. He's got his guitar, and apparently he's not very good. And a chap comes up who says he's the talent scout, and he gives him a business card, and it's from Serview Inc. And now, if we know anything, Serview Inc. is the creators of the theme park that we saw in issue number 2 of this comic book, the theme park where, you know, there was an evil protoplasm creature controlling that theme park and the employees, and the Doctor defeated it. Well, this guy seems to be from the same company, and he tells this young lad to go out and, you know, we assume meet the devil. And who does he meet? He meets the Doctor, but the Doctor is possessed. And before we know it, a guy who we've never seen before rushes in. He's in a modern day suit. He's clearly not from the 1930s. He grabs the Doctor. Alice Oberfune, the Doctor's new companion, turns up in Bessie, but it's not the Edwardian Roadster we know as Bessie. It's a bright yellow monster truck with the Who Won license plates. This new chap throws the Doctor into Bessie with Alice, and they go zooming off away from these possessed zombie-like people who are wandering along with this guy we know as the Talent Scout. And that's all before, you know, the equivalent of the opening credits, where we get told this is the 11th Doctor, the story is called What He Wants, by writer Rob Williams and artist Simon Fraser. And you've just got to stop there and think, what just happened? They're in Mississippi, Robert Johnson's on stage, this young lad goes to meet the devil, he meets the Doctor, the Doctor's possessed, there's this crowd of people, Bessie is a monster truck, who is this other guy in the modern day suit saving the Doctor with Alice? Ah, you know, it's overload, but in a really good way, because you want to turn the page and find out what the hell is going on. And of course, when you turn the page, we're back in London, it's 2014, and this is earlier, so it gives you the backstory. Now, I won't go into it in great detail, because I really don't want to spoil the story, but suffice to say, it goes into a character who is essentially David Bowie in all but name. We have the Doctor talking about going and seeing all the great gigs. We learn that David Bowie might not have been all that in his early gigs. He wanders into the TARDIS. Hilarity ensues. I'm really doing it a disservice, but I'm really not wanting to give too many spoilers here. But if you like the idea of being in the Mississippi with Robert Johnson, a character who is essentially David Bowie, the Doctor and his new companion, possessed people, someone from this evil corporation we met last issue, and wondering how it all ties together, then this is the story that I think you want to read. I was very, very satisfied by this. It's another one-shot story. We get some more insight into that mysterious Time Lord figure we've been seeing pop up here and there. And while that doesn't play out fully in this issue, we do get more of a sense of what's going on with that. And that's just tantalizing. This makes me want to read issue number 4. They're not going to be in the same place again. Alice and the Doctor will be somewhere else doing something different. I wonder if there'll be some people from Serview Inc., wherever they go. That seems to be the big bad. That seems to be the arc that's going through all these one-shot stories, this Serview Inc. story. And I think it's great for the Doctor to be up against this evil corporation who can apparently appear, you know, at different places in time and space. How are they managing to do that? How does the Time Lord fit into things? You know, again, I'm really not wanting to go into exact details because I'd love for you to go out and buy this issue and support Titan Comics as they pump out more 11th Doctor stories. If you love the Matt Smith Doctor, you should be getting this as a matter of course. And, you know, if you love the 10th Doctor, you should be doing the same with their 10th Doctor stories. They are obviously going to put out a 12th Doctor range as well. We talked about that in the news section, which is very exciting. But, you know, with comic books, you need to support them. You need to support the single issues. You can't wait until there are collected editions. I know they're nice to get, but you really need to be out there down at your local comic book shop, hopefully an independent, buying these things and really supporting the comic book industry, because it's not a huge industry, particularly at this level. You need to get in there and show that you support these things, otherwise they'll just go away. And then there'll be no Doctor Who comics. Well, there'd be a Doctor Who comic in Doctor Who magazine, but there'd be no standalone Doctor Who comics, let alone a 10th Doctor, 11th Doctor, and 12th Doctor range all happening simultaneously. Get out there and support it. This rant is brought to you by the fact that this is a really great comic book. If this was a really, you know, like, wasn't too fussed on this, I wouldn't be saying any of this. But this story is really great. I think the arc is going places. I think there's some real creativity. I think there's some really great writing. The artwork really does seem to suit the adventures and the Matt Smith Doctor himself. I can't say enough good things about this. Please get out there. Please support it. If you are a reader of the comic, why not write in to hello@whowars.net and let me know what you think of this issue and the ones that have come before it. Why not record an MP3? Why not send me a tweet? I'd love to know what other comic book readers think. I know there's a few of you out there because you have a thread on Gallifrey Vase for both the 10th and 11th Doctor Rangers. I've written in both and I've had people give feedback in both. So more feedback, please. Let's talk about these Doctor Who comics. They're a nice addition to Doctor Who now that the 10th and 11th Doctors have left our screens. They're gone but not forgotten. We can read all these great new adventures and see what they're up to with Titan Comics. Please consider.
Hi, I'm going to be doing a review of The Caretaker. And I'm just gonna start off by saying I'm not crazy about this episode. I'm sorry if you are. I mean, it has its great moments. I thought it was funny. It wasn't as funny as The Lodger. I think Gareth Roberts has done better work than this. But there were some funny parts. My favorite lines included the otters joke. I lived with otters once for a month. That was amusing. And I liked how the Doctor helped out with the history of Pride and Prejudice in the classroom. I mean, that goes back to the roots of the show, when Doctor Who was created as a way to teach history to children. And I liked the go away human sign, that was funny, and the there has been a spillage joke, twice, with Courtney Woods, all over again eating paper towels for Courtney and the TARDIS. Those moments were great, but I had some problems with this episode. My first problem? The big "the Doctor doesn't like soldiers" issue. In this episode, apparently soldiers can't teach mathematics. And this is really just going too far. It used to be funny, sort of, but it's not funny anymore. The Doctor really doesn't like soldiers. He's completely prejudiced, and it's a little bit too simple-minded for me. I don't like this version of the Doctor that has been created in this episode. I'm going to have to kind of repress this episode in my mind if I'm going to keep loving Doctor Who as I do. The Doctor is just plain weird in this episode. He has some lines about princesses, which I didn't get. I hope there is some reference that I didn't get, but hey, no, I didn't understand. He talks about, in the TARDIS, like, mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the most dangerous of them all? He says that line referencing Snow White, I suppose. Don't know why. About a death ray, and there is a green glow, I guess. And then later he calls the Scovox Blitzer killing machine thing a sleeping beauty, and he invites it to dance. I don't know what he's doing. I suppose if you want to stretch it, it could be kind of a theme about love. You know, princes and princesses falling in love. And the doctor, you know, his one great love is fighting the bad guys. So maybe that's one explanation for the strangeness of this episode, partially. Just as strange as the doctor is Clara in this episode, if not more so. Actually, I'm going to go with more so. We've never seen her act like such a spaz before. It disturbed me. She was acting like a total control freak gone haywire, and for the most unnecessary reasons. Just annoying. For me, it actually started with, I think, her first line of the episode, with her and the doctor on some alien desert planet. Really amusing, but her line about, what was it? Something about like a vibra cutter, something like that. Vibro cutters. You couldn't even hear the word. It was like this episode wasn't really edited and directed as well as it should have been. Like somebody should have said, hey, your diction might want to be improved there. Can we redo this? You're talking too quickly. Again, it was Clara acting like a spaz. And in that case, it not only reflected her character as crazy, but reflected just bad taste in the directors of the show for not fixing that line, because you couldn't understand what the heck they were saying. They were talking so fast and, you know, acting like crazy people. So there was that problem. And then, of course, there is the giant problem of this episode of Danny meeting the doctor as he really is for the first time, being confronted with an alien being sucked into a vortex. And then Clara has to deal with it by putting on some kind of charade about it being a school play. It was absurd. She was legitimately off the wall in this episode, and I'm blaming it on the writing of the script. That scene, the important scene, where Danny is finally seeing the doctor as he is, it's a very important scene, could have been written differently. I think in a way that was a little bit more believable. Clara seems like a nutcase in this moment. You know, she's all like, shh, shh, don't tell, it's a school play. Like, nobody even acts like that. Something less absurd would have been preferable. Like, I get how she's trying to make that one last attempt to hide her secret, but it could have been done differently. It was embarrassing to watch. I don't know, maybe I'm being too harsh on this all. So, enough about that. Let me focus on some of the things I thought were important and positive contributions to the show of Doctor Who in the giant scheme of things. So there was that big line that Clara finally gave to the world about her love for Danny Pink. It was wonderful, except the doctor really didn't like it. And for good reasons, I think. It's all revealed and his reaction of, well, why would you say that? Is this part of the play? It's revealing in the way that something, I guess we've always known, the doctor just doesn't do that love thing. It's icky, you know, it's your shoes stuck in the muck, figuratively. And it's never good. So the doctor has always kind of stayed away from that. I suppose, yeah, there are those exceptions with maybe Rose and maybe River. It's all kind of flirtations. It's all a game. And not that he thinks that love is a game. I think he cares about all human beings. He loves every human. But he's not one to be romantically in love, you know, whenever the great big passionate love thing. And that's a big deal. Like, for the sake of the show and his character, we depend on that so we can keep having companions and things don't get weird. And I think this moment where he says, why would you say that? There was a huge miscommunication going on that is finally made clear to us, that the doctor has thought that Clara was like him, that Clara didn't like the idea of love, was independent from that concept, didn't like boys, wasn't thinking in that way. She just wanted to see amazing things and wonders. Simplistic. But it was there. There was that miscommunication, and it's confusing and kind of heart-wrenching to see that happen between two characters that should be really, really close. You know, they travel time and space together, they spend all this time. The doctor devotes a lot of effort to getting her back on time and picking her up over and over and over. You know, clearly the doctor really cares about what he and Clara have as a pair. You know, fighting all the bad stuff in the world. And it appears kind of not to be that true, because Clara hasn't been honest with him. She's been putting up some kind of front. I guess she does care about love, and worse, she's been hiding it from the doctor. So there is that revelation, and apparently it does matter to the doctor, and I think Clara has underestimated him. I can even go so far as to say that Clara has betrayed him. Things got shaken up. Oh, and the other line that's important in this episode is how the doctor tells Clara, hey, you've explained me to Danny, but you haven't explained Danny to me. That line, which isn't a direct quote, but you know which one I'm talking about. That was real to me. No more absurdities there. I think that moment could have been a huge development in the show that was just kind of glanced over and neglected. What should have happened, in my opinion, at that moment was that Clara spoke up about what has been going on in her life and her thoughts and why she hid that from the doctor and what she really thinks of the doctor, all that, anything from her. That could have been the moment. And, you know, I thought this season was going to take advantage of that, was going to enlighten us as to who Clara is. I thought they were going to do that. But no, I think we took a step backwards with this episode, which was disappointing. This episode could have been something more. And I know Gareth Roberts can be really funny and deep at the same time. The Lodger showed that. So, I don't know what happened. Maybe they were rushed on time with things. It's almost the middle of the season. Maybe they think they could let this one just slide, you know, keep everything lighthearted. Don't take the doctor's musings about soldiers too seriously. Don't think too much into Clara's mild insanity. And just glide over it into the next part of the season. Alright, so overall, I think I'm okay with this episode, and we can forgive and forget some things, and looking forward to next week. So thanks for listening again, and have a great week. Bye.
Hey there, listeners. I'm back this week on the Who side of things to give you another review from the BBC's new series Adventure original audiobooks. This week I'll be doing the one called The Forever Trap, which was released in October of 2008. It's written by Dan Abnett and read by Catherine Tate. And just a note before we start, this review is going to be a bit more spoilery than my last Doctor Who review, so if you're spoiler sensitive, skip to the next segment. Okay, so here we go. This one features the 10th Doctor and Donna Noble, a vivid supporting cast of various aliens, nanobots, and a massive blob that feeds off the emotions of everyone. And it takes place on this giant structure of luxury apartments called the Edifice. But more on that later. We start with Donna and the Doctor in the TARDIS when they hit a time eddy. Amidst the turbulence, the TARDIS gets spammed with a smarmy holographic salesman offering a too-good-to-be-true space-time share. See what I did there? Donna unintentionally signs the contract when she touches the binding agreement, and that transports her and the Doctor to the luxury massive apartment complex called the Edifice. The Edifice is a fascinating structure that uses dimensional folding to create a topsy-turvy M.C. Escher-like effect. These apartments contain Egyptian cotton sheets, holographic images from the Doctor and Donna's homeworlds, and a strange array of alien neighbors. Abnett does an excellent job with his description of these various aliens. from the little old lady with tentacles, to the pewter man who walks a rat thing with pink pom-poms for ears, to the toad, fox, and mollusk-like species, and the list goes on. These vivid descriptions really help to solidly visualize the story. So all these various aliens, they're trapped in the edifice, which is like an endless prison for them, and they succumb to an ever-rising tide of paranoia, which kind of reminded me of a classic episode of The Twilight Zone. The Doctor and Donna are suspected of being murderers and thieves, and specifically accused of murdering a squid family. Then, out of nowhere, a crew of several metal sentry-looking warriors, complete with turquoise crests and sewing machine guns, ambush the neighbors and send the Doctor and Donna into hiding. To escape, they climb out the window of the edifice onto the metal bulkhead of the apartment's exterior. And so it's on the other side of those projections that they saw earlier. So we find out that the metal guys are Conturan stormtroopers. They are conquerors who conquer without remorse. And when the threat of them subsides, Donna and the Doctor go back into the structure, and they discover that the level they're on has experienced major destruction caused by these mysterious brown stains. The dry rot then causes the Doctor to fall down this ominous cavern. When Donna goes to find the Doctor, they discover the cause of the mysterious stains, nanovores. Nanovores are microscopic robots that behave like termites, and they destroy everything in their path. Eventually, they learn to adapt to the sonic screwdriver, and Donna and the Doctor are rescued by the lift attendant Frank. Frank eventually brings Donna and the Doctor to management level, and they discover who's really in charge. The Ilk. The Ilk is a large white blob that feeds on the emotions of everyone. They learn that the edifice used to be a legitimate establishment before the Ilk took it over. Donna saves the day when her disgust and disapproval end up giving it indigestion. Then the Doctor uses the sentient spam filter to send the Ilk somewhere where it can't hurt anyone ever again, and he sends all the remaining living people back to the places where they belong. Okay, so on to my thoughts. As much as I love David Tennant reading that last story, Catherine Tate did a superb job. She is a hilarious actress, and it really shows through in this. Her varied voices were very entertaining, and they were also useful in differentiating the many alien species. So I also really enjoyed the music and effects. The music was used sparingly but effectively, and the parts with the salesman in particular, they had this perfect jingly-sounding melody that just really added to the story. And then also the effects in the story were good. Some of them were minor details, like the elevator door dinging, or the hum of the nanovores, or the sounds of the Ilk. But it's little stuff like that that really adds dimension to an audiobook story like this. Now, there were also some pretty good nods to classic Doctor Who. At one point, Donna has a panic attack and the Doctor hands her a paper bag, and so she inhales into it and she tells him that it smells like jelly babies, to which he responds, "Did it?" There's also a part where Donna asks the Doctor if he has a scarf on him, so that was funny. I liked this book because it had relevant topics to our day, such as spam, user agreements, paranoia, so I thought the use of those was really clever. I also really liked the interaction between the Doctor and Donna. I didn't get to see that so much in the last story, because in the last story, Donna and the Doctor are split up during most of the book. So I liked in this book, you could really feel the interaction between the two. And then there's the running joke about Donna and the Doctor being a couple that's mentioned more than once in this one, so that was pretty funny. But overall, I thought this was a really intriguing setting. It had crystal clear descriptions of the many minor characters, and then also relevant topics to our day. So I give this one 9 sonic screwdrivers out of 10. I hope you have enjoyed my review of The Forever Trap. Stay tuned next time when I review the next audiobook in the series. Until then, allons-y, and may the Force be with you.
So here we are at the end of the 5th Who Wars. What did you think of that episode? I think we just get better and better each week. I think our content gets more interesting. I think the contributors are really coming along. I think the team's building well. And I'd love to hear your feedback on it. Be sure to send in questions or comments, details on how to, in the credits package I'm about to hit play on, including MP3 files. If you'd like to hear your question or comment on the show in your own voice, please get in touch that way. Also, if you're an iTunes user, please jump on iTunes and give us a rating and a review, even if it's only a sentence or two. Ratings and reviews help boost us up the rankings, and in doing that, you help other people just like you find the show when they're on iTunes. That would be hugely appreciated. All right, then. Thank you for listening this week. Good night, and we'll see you again on Wednesday night, 7 p.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time. We have moved to daylight savings here in Australia. I hope you really enjoy our take on Series 8 of Doctor Who. Cheers. See ya.
Well, that wraps it up for another episode of Who Wars. If you'd like to be in touch with the show, simply email hello@whowars.net. Find us on Twitter @WhoWars, or if Facebook's more your thing, at facebook.com/WhoWars. Oh, and don't forget to leave us a rating on iTunes. See you next time. Oh,